Interesting time talking about before. Michael has been doing a great deal of hard work to try and resolve all of your difficulties and problems identified then, and has got a few short papers to deliver to us today. let's see what we can cover in the pre-lunch session.
I was going to say, don't forget Jay Ho as well, because he's been the significant worker and doer in all this process. But agenda papers 3A through 3D are talking about our ongoing vesting, non-vesting condition. Agenda paper 3A is simply a summary of the information we have to look forward, as well as a very brief summary in the appendices to paper 3A of what we had previously talked about, primarily focusing on the tentative thoughts that were discussed in the May meeting, as well as the staff's recommendations. Paper 3B goes on to address concerns that the committee members had requested us to tackle, providing more guidance and specificity around what is and is what is not a performance condition. We've attempted to do that, and we look forward to your comments on whether we've succeeded. Paper 3C deals with specific examples that we had requested committee members and anyone else who happened to write in or provide us with those specific examples that we could provide back for your consideration of both current accounting treatments, is it clear, so to say, or is there potential diversity in practice, and how the staff envisage the application of our recommendations on that specific fact pattern. Paper 3D then provides simply for background thoughts and thinking, potential drafting as we see it, provided all the staff recommendations are accepted. Paper 3D is simply there for additional consideration. It's not intended that you make broad decisions as to the strategy and forward nature of this project simply based on our drafting. We hope that you take that with a grain of salt. With that said, I think I will turn it over to Jay Ho, who will focus on paper 3B and talk about our aspects of performance condition and how we see it could be more discreetly defined.
Well, maybe before Jay Ho starts, remind everybody that the discussion today is not based on any previous decision which we haven't taken as to whether we're going to issue an interpretation, whether we're going to issue an annual improvement, whether we're going to recommend that there's a separate project on this, or even that we're going to do nothing at all. This is to try and get agreement on what the issues are that we'd identified as being the troublesome factors before, and whether or not we've actually achieved that within these papers. It's a final and later consideration that we have to take if we agree on these papers or on the conclusions in these papers, then we'll decide what it is we're going to recommend for action to resolve the practice problems. So, Jay Ho, over to you.
Thank you. The purpose of Agenda Paper 3B is to analyze what constitutes a performance condition, because current IFRS 2 does not make it clear. This analysis was conducted as the committee asked the staff at the last meeting. In a nutshell, the staff concluded a performance condition must be constituted by the combination of an explicit or an implicit service requirement and a performance target defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. Our conclusion is consistent with US GAAP on a general basis. In reaching this conclusion, we perceive two attributes that a performance condition should have. First attribute one, employee is able to influence the achievement of the target. And second attribute two, the achievement of target is in the interest of the entity. These attributes are hinted at in the basis for conclusion 171 of IPAS 2, which says the usual reason for imposing a performance condition is to provide an incentive for the employees to work toward specified performance targets. Setting the incentive exists only if the employee is able to influence whether the target will be met, and the performance target is meant to be in the interest of the entity. As for attribute 1, we think that a performance condition may be identified as either an internal target or external target, and only the internal target is considered to be influenced by the employee. By an internal target, we try to mean a performance target whose achievement is determined predominantly by internal forces within the entity, such as entity's sales volume, or profit, or EPS. Analysis of specific examples are provided in paragraph 8 through 11 of the agenda paper. As for attribute 2, we believe that an incentive may result in a quality of service toward the entity only if the incentive is coming out from the performance target that is in the interest of the entity. Otherwise, for example, if the entity imposes a target to incentivize the employee to bear more children at the instruction of the government, the target is only in the interest of the employee or the government, but not in the interest of the entity. So the target is unlikely to drive up the quality of service towards the entity.
Go ahead, continue.
We think an internal target takes on attribute 2 as well as attribute 1. As for both attributes, the committee needs to be aware that those attributes may be assessed not only on the level of an individual entity, but also on the level of the consolidated group, given a group service payment transaction is also within the scope of the IPAS 2. In conclusion, we believe the combination of attributes 1 and 2 may constitute a robust principle, and that principle may be fairly represented by a performance target, defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. However, we do not believe that attribute 1 and 2 should be laid down in IPAS 2 so that they are reviewed or applied by an entity to every single case. We would rather suggest that attribute 1 and 2 should be used as a committee's justification for the new definition of performance condition. Nonetheless, let's find out that there remain some controversial examples that may not easily fit into attribute 1 or 2. IPO, change of control, and saving requirement in SAY plan are those examples. IPO is specified as an example of a performance condition both in IPAS 2 and in US GAAP. Change of control is specified as an example of a performance condition in US GAAP, but not in IFRS 2. Saving requirement in SAY plan is currently accounted for as a non-vesting condition, but it used to be accounted for just like performance condition by some companies before the January 2008 amendment. When we assess these examples on the attributes, IPO and change of control seem to be lacking in attribute 1, i.e. they are less likely to be influenced by the employee, and saving requirement in an SAY plan seems to be lacking in attribute 2, i.e. it is less likely to be in the interest of the entity. from a narrow viewpoint, all of these three examples may not constitute performance conditions, but fall into other vesting conditions according to our proposed classification. Nonetheless, SEP think they should be treated like a performance condition to secure consistent accounting treatment within IFRS 2 and consistent accounting treatment with US GAAP. The detail of the reasoning is provided in paragraph 34 of the agenda paper. Some might be concerned that our proposal includes a rule for specific examples, but we do think our inclusive reasoning does not compromise the principle of IPAS 2. Finally, SEP recommend a performance condition must be constituted by the combination of explicit or implicit service requirement and a performance target defined by reference to the operation or activities of the entity. Also, we recommend IPO, change of control, and saving requirement in SAOI plan should be treated like a performance condition for consistency within IFRS 2 and with US GAAP. Does the committee agree with the SEP recommendation?
All right, let's take it question at a time, first of all. So we'll just focus on question one, and that's looking at the two attributes that SARF proposes we include as part of our rationale. Ruth?
I agree with the conclusion you've got to in your example. So when, after I'd been through all of this and then tried to work through each of the examples and tried to see if there was some sort of logical, rational sequence, I found that for the most part there was. But when thinking about why that was, I didn't see it as being in the interest of the entity as being the attribute for the performance condition. I saw it as being either related to the employer's operations and or able to be influenced by the employer. So there's influence by the employee, which I think is a necessary attribute. There's influence by the employer, which I think is a necessary attribute, and there's relationship to the employer's operations. And you've sort of got that in the proposed definitional change in Agenda Paper 3D. Because to me what we're trying to distinguish between is non-market performance conditions and market performance conditions, because that's where we get the difference in accounting, if you go right back to where we get the difference. And so when you came through your examples, IPO, change of control, those were within the control or influence of the employer and may or may not be related to their operations, but they were within the influence of the company as opposed to the market. So I think you got the line right in the accounting consequences, but I still think the attributes that you've identified, the in the interest of the entity, to me seemed a bit strange, I must say. I would have seen that attribute as influenced by the entity and related to the operation. And I think that's where you ended up in the definition anyway. But to me, just at the end of the day, when I worked through each of the examples, I think you've got the line about right, but it's between market and non-market.
So you like the answer, but the rationale needs some more work. Ben?
I basically also like the answer because I like the principles behind it. I'm not sure if when you look at paragraph 21B and you say that the entity's share price is not considered to be within the influence of the employee, I think it depends on the level of hierarchy you're looking at, because the CEO, I guess, does have direct influence on the share price. So if he's the one you're looking at and he's still an employee of the company, I'm not sure that this is correct. If it's someone low down, then you're right. But if you look at the CEO or board members, I think it's different.
Gita?
Well, looking at the two characteristics, I have actually problems with attribute one, because I don't think that this solves the problem that we have. I think that was exactly the question that was asked. How much influence does an employee have to have on the performance target in order for it to be a performance condition? Now, when I look at the, and I understand that this is really hard to make, and I will come up with a solution at the end of what I'm saying, but if I look at paragraph 12, where the staff tried to distinguish between what can be influenced by an employee, what can't be, then we are reading words like can be determined predominantly by internal forces. External is something that cannot be predominantly determined by internal forces. I have a problem with that because that's really a fuzzy definition. I don't think that solves the problem that we have right now. And maybe we will not be able to come up with a correct or straight line definition about what is a performance that is done by an employee and influences the performance target. Maybe at the end of the day, we could come up with a solution that is, as I understand you, a gap, that is something that is in paragraph 23. And if I understand you, a gap correctly, what they say is, if there is something that adds to the performance of an entity, either in absolute or in relative ways to other companies, then this is a performance target. And we assume that employees can influence that. And that includes an IPO or a change in control because, at least in Germany, I think also in other countries, a CEO or CFO is an employee of the company. They don't own the company, they're not the shareholders. So the problem that I have with the attribute is I understand where the staff's trying to go to, but I think it doesn't solve the problem that we see right now. And maybe it would be easier to just say, well, everything that adds to the performance of a company is presumed to be something that can be influenced by the employees.
So, Guido, when you say adds to the performance of a company, are you talking about the performance of the share price only, or?
Well, no, that would include earnings per share. That would also include the share price. I think it's also in the interest of the employees that the share price rises, especially when you are in a share-based payment situation that we have right here. If you have an option for shares, I as an employee would be interested to raise the share price. That's for sure, that I would try to make that, maybe even more than earnings per share. So share prices would also be included in the performance target. The second question is then what Ruth said is, for practicability reasons, we may end up and say that this is a performance target, but for practicability reasons, as it is in IFRS 2 right now, we took that into the grant date for value, and we are not truing it up over the period of time. And that's what I understand IFRS 2 says right now. Well, that's the difference to a market-based condition as to a non-market-based condition, which makes sense to me because it's practical. But they are all performance conditions. The problem that the staff has, and I understand it, is really looking at this principle, and we see that in the paper. So the staff recognize the problems itself is how can we include this IPO, the change of control, the save as you earn issue into this principles. And I said, well, maybe we have a problem to do that. Let's just define that they are performance conditions, which, you know, is something that I would not like to have in the standard, in a principle-based standard.
Okay.
I had a similar concern as Guido, and I, in just a couple of things, in looking at paragraph 12 in A and B, where we define EPS as an internal target and share price as an external target, that doesn't make sense to me because share price studies have shown that company share price is really based upon its earnings growth. So it doesn't make sense that they have to be the same, whether they're internal or external. I also think that there's a presumption here that we talk about the employee has to be able to influence. I think there's a presumption that any employee has to be able to influence, because otherwise then you'd have to do a separate evaluation for options issued to each and every person, where you typically give a grant to a whole group of people. I think that would become unwieldy, and maybe we need to clarify that assumption.
I think the rationale that the staff have proposed would be a rationale that potentially could be included in the basis for conclusions. You are correct in that we would not be presuming or recommending that this would be something that you would have to decide individual award by award. Rather, it would be, this is the committee's rationale as to why an internal target or metric of the entity is a performance condition, period, end of story, and any employee within the consolidated reporting group is deemed to be acting, you know, on the benefit of the entity. So it would not be an active decision then. It's obviously an active decision that we're talking about now. As far as differences between earnings per share and share prices, and, you know, are they linked, aren't they? Yes, I definitely believe they do have some level of correlation. But consistent with, in paragraph 24 of the paper, it's quoting some basis of conclusions in U.S. GAAP. If you get down to B178, I personally agree with this rationale that the more you incorporate external variables into that target, the less and less amount of influence you have. So if it's an internal target, well, there are some factors that come into play. You know, is there just a boom in the economy, so people will probably be buying more sales anyway, and other things. Once you get into the external stock market, your entity personally could be doing great, but the overall stock market and your actual stock price of your company may be decreasing despite your company doing great. So it's just adding more and more variability. We thought this would be an appropriate place to draw the line. Obviously, Gita certainly disagrees, and it seems like you do as well. That's where we thought would be a reasonable place to draw the line.
Laurence?
The principles look fine when expressed, but looking at all the cases, I have great difficulty applying them into practice, and so we can see through the papers that it leads to setting up bright lines, such as also, well, we talk about TPA share price, but I can talk about change of control. Say it is in the interest of the entity, but what about those cases where you have takeover bids that are offensive and not, you know, where it was not the will of the employees, neither the company itself? So also when we talk about the ability of employees to influence, as long as it is an internal target, I have sometimes difficulty saying it is in the reach of the employees' influence, for example, particularly even more when you are including all sister subsidiaries, targets, and so on. So unfortunately, I tend to come to the view that starting to be convinced that those changes are not bringing improvements compared to what we have as a current text. And I'm questioning, is there anything we can do? And particularly, one of those areas where you are effectively possibly bringing help is in those cases where the performance target extends beyond the service period, where you say, well, this is a non-vesting condition. But I think that where you get to, perhaps we can get to similarly under the current literature. So I do have concerns where we are going and whether it is going to be helpful.
Charlotte?
Well, I would like to congratulate J-Ho because I thought it was an excellent paper, and I agree with it and the recommendations wholeheartedly. I disagree with Guido and Peggy and Laurence to a certain extent. I think that it is clearly articulated what the principles are. They are short, they are succinct compared to what we have in the standard now, and we're kidding ourselves if we think we are going to be able to actually come up with something that gives an answer to every single situation where you don't have to apply judgment. Accounting is about applying judgment. We cannot create rules for every situation, and I think that what this does, quite frankly, is actually give something that is clear, succinct. Yes, there is the use of judgment. I don't call it a bright line, as opposed to some very clear ways of thinking. So I agree with all three of your questions in terms of does the committee agree?
Scott?
I thought the principles were good. I think they are. They do underlie the thinking that's already in the standards, but bringing them out and thinking about them distinctly, I think, is helpful. If we're worried about what words are going to work the best in practice, I would tell you that I do not believe practitioners in U.S. GAAP have trouble figuring out the difference between a market condition and a performance condition. And so whatever words are in U.S. GAAP, I was going to say FAS 123R, but that's wrong, ASC 718, I think, they work. Now, maybe there's something else in the United States that people have as a background or framework that makes the words work in the U.S. that might not exist elsewhere in the world, but I'm not aware of it. And I do think that in the U.S. people have not had trouble distinguishing performance conditions from market conditions. I'm not sure I agree with everything in all of these papers, but as far as that, I think the principles that the staff has elicited are the right ones. I think they underlie the thinking in U.S. GAAP, and if you want words that work, the U.S. GAAP words have been proven to work, at least in the U.S.
Peggy, you wanted to comment on that?
Yeah, I wasn't saying that I disagreed with the SAS principles. I just think it's a wording issue.
Okay. Andrew?
Well, a couple of points. I mean, I think picking up on Peggy's point, there is quite a lot of interdependency between internal and external factors. And sales growth drives share price, and external factors can also affect sales growth, for example. So that's one point. In terms of attribute two, in the interest of the entity, I can kind of understand where the staff's going to here, but I would have thought there must be an underlying assumption that when entities set up these arrangements, the fundamental assumption must be the whole thing is in the interest of the entity. So why you need to elaborate on that, I don't know. And just coming back to Laurence's point, I mean, I do feel... I know you wanted to, you've asked us to postpone to the end what we're going to do with this, but I do think there's an element of reverse engineering principles here, which we seem to be working towards solutions which might be quite sensible solutions, and then trying to get the principles to fit them. And I am concerned that we are biting off far more than we're going to chew here, and I don't know how many. We've already had some discussions around some of these things. I could see us here for several hours and several more meetings discussing some of these issues. So I have some significant reservations as to where this is going.
Thank you for deferring your comments on whether we can reach consensus on a timely basis until later on. Jean?
First, I want to go on record that this is an excellent paper, and all the papers actually were excellent. I want to mention that. Now, on the principle, I got hung up with the employees able to influence and the connection with the share price. In North America, the usage is to provide a stock option to employees to incentivize, to make them perform well or and stay with the enterprise, but this is only a value to me if the price increases. So I must be working to increase the price. Must be an incentive to increase the price. So through the earnings. But that's to echo Peggy. And I was concerned about we claim that we have a robust framework, but at the same time we can't fit all of them in it. So having heard the Guido, I think that's a better approach to see a certain market target as performance obligation, but then for whatever reason take them out. I don't know.
Jean-Louis?
I quite share the opinion expressed by Joanna and Scott. I think that the idea that the concept of trying to define a specific performance condition in relation to a service condition and the two criteria which have been put forward, in my view, are a progress. And I am quite sure that if you try to figure out the conclusion in a very specific example, you might get to difficulties. But in my view, it does not put it does not create a situation to change the principle. I mean, because I think this is a difficult area. For example, employable to influence basically is quite different to say if you attribute stock options to a cash employee in a supermarket, it's as different from the boss. That's quite obvious. But there is part; it's part of a collective effort in order to create value. So I quite agree with those two principles, even if there are difficulties at the end of the day to make a specific solution, because we will have always difficulties, but it's in progress in my view.
Thanks. Ruth?
Yeah, just to reiterate, I agree with what Joanna said, and I think what Scott said about US GAAP. I think at the end of the day, if we go right back to the beginning, the questions that were asked of us, how do we deal with interacting conditions, multiple conditions, how can we distinguish between market and non-market? The principles that the staff have come up with, combined with the US GAAP definitions effectively, I think get us there. Sitting back and thinking about it, what does that mean? It seems to me that we could recraft our definitions to be consistent with the codified FAS 123R, and we can achieve convergence and help people at the same time. That, to me, that seems that's worth pursuing. And we could spend hours arguing about what employees can or can't influence. I don't think that's worth our while doing. I think we can see US GAAP has an answer. It says look at the operations of the entity, link it to service. That's a performance condition. And to me, it helps us get there. And I would agree as well. I think the staff have done excellent work on this and working through the examples with myself not being an IFRS 2 expert. I was able to go through each example and think in my own mind, what's the line between the market and the non-market? How would I have come up with it? And in most cases, that was the answer you came up with. So that said to me that I was applying a principle that I was able to work. And perhaps that's why it works in US GAAP. But at the end of the day, it looks like we take the IFRS 2 definitions out and replace them with FAS 123R definitions, and we're there, more or less.
Just a small step to change it. Bernd?
Well, I agree with the principles, and if there is a workable solution in US GAAP, I think we can rather take it and apply it into IFRS 2 instead of doing the work ourselves. when I look at
all the other 14,000 pages.
Well, not exactly. On the other hand, if I look at the principles again, I'm not sure if we need principle 2, because achievement of the target in the interest of the entity, if it was not in the interest of the entity, would they agree upon it, or would they put it down in the plan? I doubt it. So you don't need the second principle. You only need the first principle. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the scheme anyway. On the other hand, what Peggy mentioned, I doubt that applying this principle, you can account for company-wide schemes in the same way, because I think you have to look at the individual employee's ability to influence the performance. You cannot say just, you know, all employees influence a certain, of course they do influence a certain amount of targets, but you have to clearly define who influences which target. So I doubt if it's possible to apply to employee to company-wide schemes.
I guess considering the prior board rationale and considerations on being within a consolidated reporting entity versus not, are you in the family or not, so to say, and the prior discussions and decisions on group share-based payment transactions, and the fact that any entity within a consolidated group that provides a share-based payment award to any other employee within that consolidated group is deemed to be a share-based payment and you need to follow IFRS 2, we thought this was consistent with that rationale. And I guess additionally, it may be practically very difficult to have individual companies applying this in potentially less comparable ways if each company needs to apply it differently each time. And if the company is giving an award in the first place, I would presume they're doing it for the betterment of the consolidated reporting entity. So I'm second guessing why management makes that choice. That's my rationale, I guess.
Okay, thanks for that, Michael. You're always trying to get in right at the end, and we're not actually finishing this debate in this paper at the moment. I was going to suggest that we take a break for lunch now, so the staff can reflect on your comments. There have been a number of you who've expressed concern and reservations about the principles, and whether or not they are going to represent an improvement. And there have also been some suggestions that we perhaps think of changing IFRS 2 by changing the definitions to align with US GAAP. And that wasn't the recommendation that the staff had. So I want to reflect over those or on those over lunch. And we'll get back to this. And I'll ask you the questions then at 2 o'clock.